welcome to another edition of Backroads and Backwaters. I'm your host, Terry Guthrie, located in Central North Carolina, and this season we will be traveling around my home state. Today in particular, we'll be focused on the Outer Banks area, Hatteras Island, and a specific location called the Chickamaucomico Life Saving Station. I know that sounds like a mouthful, but I have a guest with me today who will help explain what that means and tell us more about the Life Saving Station. My guest is John Griffin, who is a volunteer board member in the restoration project of the Life Saving Station. Hello, John. Welcome to our program. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good.
Good. I'm excited to have you on. I've been learning more and more about the Life Saving Station, and I think there's some really valuable information here that I think our listeners will be able to glean from your knowledge. And I've actually been hearing about you too, that you're the go-to guy when it comes to knowledge about the Life Saving Station too. I don't know how you feel about that.
I'm one of a few.
So I know for me, having driven through the area for years, and I've seen this name a thousand times, but for people that the name is new to them, tell me about the name Chickamaucomico. Where does that come from? And a little bit of the background on that.
Well, Chickamaucomico is actually an Iroquois Indian phrase. It means land of shifting sand. It was actually the name of the village until the post office got here. Post office didn't like Chickamaucomico. They thought it was far too confusing. So they changed the name to Rodanthe, which is R-O-D-A-N-T-H-E with the T silent. We always wonder why that was easier, but it was. They also changed the name of other villages south of us, like Kinnikeet. Kinnikeet became Avon, and Kinnikeet was also an Iroquois Indian term. So that's Chickamaucomico. It sort of describes Barrier Island. Our islands move. Our island, particularly Hatteras Island, is about 25 miles off the coast of North Carolina. So we are the barrier for storms. On the west side of us is Pamlico Sound, and that's between us and the mainland. And they don't have waves in Pamlico Sound. They have tides, but not waves. All the waves hit this island and move it closer to the shore over time. So we move not a whole lot, but a little bit every year.
It's millimeters a year, isn't it? Isn't that what I read?
Yeah.
It's something like that. It's very, very tiny.
Yeah. But constant.
So how wide is the island?
Where I live, if I put it in urban terms, I live three blocks from the Sound and three blocks from the ocean. I can see the ocean and the Sound from my bedroom.
Oh, nice view. Probably get some good sunsets.
We get good sunrise and good sunset.
And then how long is the island?
The island's about 50 miles long. We have one road that goes from top to bottom on the island. That's a little longer because it does do a couple of little bends. But the island's about 50 miles long. About 25 miles of the island are either the National Seashore or a wildlife preserve. The other 25 miles is one of the seven villages that are on the island.
And they are villages, not towns.
They are villages. We have no government. We have no hard boundaries. I live in an area called Tri-Village. It's three villages, Rodanthe, Waves, and Salvo. And no one really knows where Waves ends and Salvo begins.
That's always a question I've had when I've driven through the area. I see those signs, but I never knew where the borders were between them.
Well, when I when I did an oral history with one of the old timers here, and he said, you don't really live in Salvo, John, you live in Waves. And how do I know you live in Waves? Because my grandfather grazed cattle, and he never grazed cattle in Salvo. He only grazed cattle in Waves, and he raised them right where you live. So there's really not a hard border.
So what's the history behind the life-saving stations? How many were there? When were those established?
Well, they sort of evolved, starting up at Cape Cod with, there was always an attempt to rescue people in distress. This goes back to the Good Samaritan in the Bible. It's a Judeo-Christian European model. It's not very popular in Asia. If you shipwrecked in Asia, they probably would have killed you or enslaved you. Mm. But here we have a notion of saving people. And it started out sort of catch as catch can. If we know there's a ship in distress, we're going to try to help it. But we also don't want to live too close to the ocean. So it really was catch as catch can. One wouldn't know that there was a ship in distress because that's not really where people lived, even on islands. Most of the older homes on this island are on the Sound side, not on the ocean side. Until tourism came in, then we started building on the ocean side of the islands. But started in Massachusetts by the Humane Society, put a series of huts out on the beach with supplies so that people that shipwrecked could at least survive until they could find people or people could find them. And that was the original model of life-saving. That grew. The federal government started to say, well, if it worked in Cape Cod, maybe it'll work in Jersey. So they started at Jersey Shore. It didn't work out at all. Within a year, all of the supplies were gone. People were squatting in the cabins. So that didn't work. So they established in the early 1974, established a life-saving service. And it was going to be a paid position. So people were going to be on duty, particularly during hurricane season. It wasn't a year-round job to begin with. And it was riff with patronage. Many people were employed as surfmen who were the ne'er-do-well nephews of rich tobacco farmers in the middle of North Carolina and never saw the ocean before. There was a tragic failure to rescue a passenger schooner that had 150 people on board, and within sight of a station, all hands were lost. 150 people died. Wow. In the ocean. The life-saving service failed to respond. So General Grant, who was now President Grant, called in a fellow named Sumner Kimball, and he told Sumner Kimball to fix it. So Sumner Kimball was not a touchy-feely kind of manager. He set performance standards. He basically said, if you're going to be a surfman on Cape Cod, you're going to be a kid that grew up on Cape Cod. If you're going to be a surfman on the Great Lakes, you're going to be a kid that grew up on the Great Lakes. And if you're going to be a surfman on Hatteras Island, you're going to be a kid that grew up on Hatteras Island. This worked out very well. He hired fishermen, mostly, who knew the waters. On Hatteras Island, we had 10 stations. So that was one of Sumner Kimball's rules, regulations, performance standards, was that from the time of notification of a ship in distress, you have 2 hours to get there and rescue the people. So if you're talking about shooting a line out to a ship or taking a surf boat, launching it in the water in the middle of a hurricane, you can't go very far So we had stations about every 7 miles on Hatteras Island. We had 10 stations on Hatteras Island.
Now, how many of those are still in existence?
Well, it depends on what you mean by in existence. some stations are, there are stations that have become private homes. There are stations that have become rental properties. There are stations that have become restaurants. And there are stations that just ain't there anymore.
Let me change my question.
Is the most complete station in the United States.
I was going to say, let me change my question. How many are still active?
Active? Well, all right. Remember the 2-hour rule that I gave you?
Yes.
Okay. So now we got the Coast Guard has boats that'll do 32 knots. That's like 35 miles an hour. They have helicopters that'll go 325 miles out, pick people up, and come back 325 miles back. So how many stations do we have left here? We have one station just on the northern tip of Hatteras Island. It's actually across the inlet. It's not really on Hatteras Island, but it's right there. And the other one on the other end of Hatteras Island. But they can get there within 2 hours. They can get there within a whole lot less than 2 hours.
So with the stations themselves, the original stations, how many, do you have a number as far as how many men went through, I guess, in total for the stations? How many were staffing each individual station? Then do you have an idea of how many men actually went through the entire programs?
Well, okay, so 1874, the first station was built in North Carolina. It's on our site. It's Chickamauga Station. It was built in 1874. At that time, the complement was a keeper, who was the man in charge, and 6 surfmen. And they were on duty only a little more than half the year during hurricane season. That evolved to being a complement of a keeper and 8 surfmen. And in 1915, so 1874, we started the life-saving service. In 1915, the life-saving service merged with the Revenue Cutter Service, Hamilton's group out there in the water collecting tariffs, which was how our government ran. We had no taxes, so merged and became the Coast Guard. And in 1915, Chickamauga Life Saving Station became Chickamauga Coast Guard Station. It remained a Coast Guard station until 1954. And it was decommissioned in 54. In 54, if you think about the history of helicopters and the evolution of helicopters, that's about the time that helicopters became really, really reliable. Prior to that, everybody recognized the potential of helicopters, but they really weren't terribly reliable. The potential, I mean, people in the life-saving rescue business would look at them and say, my God, it hovers. If it hovers, we can drop a basket down and pick people up, if only the thing were reliable. So it became reliable in the very late 40s, early 50s, and stations started to be decommissioned. If you ask a young Coast Guardsman or Coast Guardswoman today, how long do you have to get to a ship in distress? They'll tell you 2 hours. And if you say, how come it's 2 hours? Probably they'll say, I don't know, that's the regulation. The Sumner Kimball regulation.
So how in the lifespan of the station being active, how many rescues were there?
I don't bother to count them. If you think of, so someone said to me just a few days ago, well, how often do they do rescues even now? And I said, well, I would say that our Coast Guard stations, our two local Coast Guard stations, do about three or four a week. And that's with all of the technology that we have now. They do two or four a week.
Okay.
So you can imagine how many they did from 1874 to 1954, through two world wars, through submarines all over the place, sinking our ships, how many hurricanes. They were busy. Every year there was an annual report of the life-saving service. So you really could go back and add them all up, but I've never done it.
Well, with the area having the name Graveyard of the Atlantic, you know it was probably a high number.
Well, there's 400 ships out there that we know of. And those are the ones that sunk out there. Think of how many sunk and got torn apart and the cargo was sold as salvage.
Mm-hmm.
Captains of sailing vessels knew that if I'm in trouble, this hurricane is coming, I want to get as close to shore as possible for a couple of reasons. Number one, my men can't swim. And number two, I know there's a life-saving service and I know they'll shoot a line out to my ship if I can get close enough.
Mm-hmm.
So those ships sometimes got close enough, and they got close enough so that we could rescue all of the people on board. But then we had the cargo coming to salvage. So it was sold at auction. Those ships, some of those ships were used for the siding on some of the houses here on Hatteras Island.
So tell me about the station itself. Now, what kind of shape was it in when your organization took over to begin managing the property and restoring it as a historic site?
Well, in 1954, it was decommissioned. And there were a couple of Coast Guardsmen who were left behind as caretakers. And they left about 1955, late 1955. And the building sat there. The building, the stations really just sat there and sat there and sat there until sometime in the 70s when the local fire company said, you know, we could burn down the station for practice. And everybody sort of just went, wait a minute. So at that time, the Historical Association was formed. It set about getting the property. The property was supposed to go back to the families that owned them, but the family that owned the properties in the 1870s was not interested. They had moved all over. There were not very many left on the island. Some of them were in Michigan, some of them were all over. So it sat there. The Park Service took it over for a while. They didn't really do anything with it. So the Historic Association started to raise money to preserve it, got someone to buy the property and donate it, and then slowly started to restore it. So we pretty much restored the 1911 station. I've been telling you about the 1874. That station was replaced in 1911, and that station is in really pretty good shape. We've redone all the siding. We've redone the roof. We don't have we don't really have heat and hot water heat, but we really don't need heat at this point. It would the heat would sort of detract. We close the day after Thanksgiving and open again around Easter time.
And how many buildings are there?
On our station, there are three buildings that we don't use. There's the boathouse for the Sound. There's a garage, a storage garage, and there's a stable. And so we have a boathouse, a garage, and a stable that are there, but we really use them for other purposes. They're not generally open to the public. We have the 1911 station, which was remodeled in 1925, and we restored it in 1917, 1918, complete restoration. Attached to that, or adjacent to that, they really weren't attached, was the cookhouse. Because if you've been on Hatteras Island, you know how windy it is.
Mm-hmm.
You don't cook in a wooden building with open flame like they would have. So there's a separate cookhouse. There's also the 1874 station and its separate cookhouse. And we have a house that belonged to a keeper, and it is furnished and set up as it was in 1908. It is set up as though it were a relatively well-to-do family who lived on the island. It is not the way everyone lived, but it's on the island, has nice cook stoves and things like that.
So what types of artifacts would I see when I come to visit?
You would see cannons that are used to shoot out, that were used to shoot out a line to a ship. You would see the surf boat that was used in Merlo Rescue. You would see a keeper's office with the keeper's log. You would see cots that the men would use when they were on duty. You would see dormitory areas where we would house shipwreck victims. You would see the cart that they would use to take the cannon out to the beach to shoot a line out.
And during the season, you actually do a reenactment of that, don't you?
Yes, we do. Sumner Kimball said that, remember we talked about performance standards. Sumner Kimball said on Tuesday and Thursday, you will take the beach cart, you will take it out to the beach. Every station had a pretend mast called a drill pole. You will set up, you will shoot a line out over that mast, and you will set up your series of pulleys like a zip line. And you will do that in under 5 minutes. And if you don't do it in under 5 minutes and there's an inspector available, you will have one more chance. And if you don't do it in under 5 minutes the second time, you're fired. We'll hire other people.
Wow.
Remember, this was a government job on an island where you can't really grow crops very well in sand. And the only way to make a living was fishing. So people would line up for a government job. And how would you do under 5 minutes? Why would you do it? Because if you did it, what if it snows? You do it every Tuesday and Thursday. What if there's a hurricane? You do it every Tuesday and Thursday, no matter what. So what happens? You get really good at doing it so that when it comes time to do it for real, you do it. You know you can.
Regardless of the weather conditions, you know you can.
You know the guy next to you can do it. You know everybody knows their job.
Now you mentioned.
So you have two things going, like any service organization, Army, Marines, Navy. You don't want to let your comrades down. And on Hatteras Island in a life-saving station, they were probably your cousins. So not only did you not want to let your comrades down, your comrade was probably your cousin.
You bring family shame. But it was also serious because it is a life-saving station. So
it's a life-saving.
It's not just reputation. You're training to save someone's life.
Yep.
Now, you mentioned kind of in the early part of that, you mentioned the Merlot Rescue. Tell me a little bit about that.
The Merlot was a British oil tanker. So a couple of dates to remember. 1915, the Life-Saving Service became the Coast Guard. So now it's 3 years later, 3 years after the merger, it's Chickamauga Coast Guard Station. Has the same people that were there when it was a life-saving station. They're all still surfmen. Surfmen still exist. There's not a lot of them in the Coast Guard, about 500. So surfman is the rating. And the keeper is, out of respect, called a captain, but he's not really a rank of a captain. He's a boatswain. Leroy Midget is up in the tower of the 1911 station. He's looking out over the ocean. It's a big crowd of ships out there, including the Merlot. The Merlot just picked up 68 tons of aviation fuel in New Orleans. And it's going up the coast to join a convoy to cross the ocean. And simultaneously, Captain Droscher is out there in U-boat 113, and he's laying mines around the light life buoy out there, as that's a choke point. Everybody's going to want to get close to that so they know it's safe. So that's where you're going to lay mines. And Leroy's up in the tower. Leroy knows there's submarines out there because the week before, a different submarine sunk the Hatteras lightship. This is August of 1918. So Droscher, the captain of the 113, puts up his periscope, sees a British oil tanker low in the water, meaning that it's filled. He torpedoes it. He makes a direct hit on the engine room of a tanker carrying 68 tons of aviation fuel. Leroy sees a bolt of flames shoot up about as high as Hatteras Lighthouse. He knows he has a case, calls down to Captain John Allen Midget Jr. and says, we got a case. So because it's 7 miles offshore, there's no hope of shooting a line to a torpedoed ship. They launched the surfboat. And the surfboat that they launch is the surfboat you will see if you come to Chickamauga. They launched the surfboat. I sort of forgot to mention that there had been a hurricane a couple of days before. So the ocean's running 15-foot waves. And eight seconds behind the 15-foot wave is another 15-foot wave. So they launch the surfboat, fail, launch it again, fail, launch it again, fail. They launch it a fourth time and manage to get in the water. And they manage to get out past the breakers. That's the dangerous part. And they head out towards this ship that's on fire. The ship is leaking fuel, of course. It's ripped open. So the ocean's on fire. About halfway out, they come across a lifeboat. Captain John Allen Midget Jr. hails the lifeboat. The lifeboat responds, I am Captain Williams. I'm captain of the Merlot. It's a British oil tanker. We've been torpedoed. I have 18 men in my lifeboat. There are two other lifeboats, and I think one of them might have got caught in the rigging coming off the ship. So Captain John Allen Midget Jr., Captain Johnny, says, wait here. You got the wrong kind of boat. Your men can't swim. And you got 15-foot waves. We'll be back. Wait here. And Captain Williams, wisely enough, waits right there. So they go out the other 3.5 miles or so, and the ocean, the fire on the surface of the ocean is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. But they do see a little way in towards the ship. They get in there. They find 6 men holding on to an overturned lifeboat, coming up for air and immediately going back under the water, coming up for air, immediately going back under the water because the water's on fire. So they pull them out, put them in the surf boat, and figure, where is the third lifeboat? Why haven't we passed it? So Captain Johnny reasons that the tide's going south, the wind's going south. We're going to go southwest to see if we can find this lifeboat. So they row. The reason they're rowing is because the fuel oil in their boat has all evaporated due to the heat of the flames. So they row another 7 miles and find a lifeboat so overcrowded that there's no room to row. And that's why it drifted. So they throw them a line and row, towing them back, a lifeboat with a number of men in it. Now by this time, the whole group has sort of drifted south. So our sister station, 7 miles away, Gulf Shoals Station, is out on the beach. So there's assistance for us. Captain Johnny makes 4 trips in and rescues 42 of 51 British seamen who live to tell another story, who live to see their children, who live to continue to fight the war. The 9 men that perished were all firemen, rating of firemen. They were probably in the engine room when it was torpedoed. They probably died in the initial explosion. John Allen Midget and his crew of 5, he should have had a crew of 8, but he had 1 man on liberty, 1 man on leave, and a vacancy. So he only had 5 guys, and he effected this rescue.
And they're, correct me if I'm wrong, they're rowing out to this burning ship with the ocean on fire, and they're rowing in a wooden boat.
Oh, yeah. and they don't know where the submarine is.
Oh, that's true. I forgot about the submarine because it may still be in the area. That's amazing. Yeah.
They didn't know for sure where the submarine was.
Now, there's a stretch of beach that was named for this rescue.
There's a whole housing development stretch of beach. A funny aside, but we just were approached. Greetings from the United Kingdom. My name is Merlo Ghose. My great-great-grandfather was the 3rd officer on the Merlo. My name is Merlo. My mother's name was Merlo. And my grandmother's name was Merlo. I have a niece named Merlo.
Wow.
And I have a granddaughter named Merlo.
And that was recently?
That was 2 days ago.
Oh my goodness. That's amazing.
It is. She knew the story from her grandfather. She knew her grandfather. Her grandfather was the 3rd officer on the Merlo. His name was Victor Wilde. For a while, he corresponded with one of the children of the people. Well, to put it in a nutshell, what happened was now they have to put up 42 survivors, and that's more than the station will hold. So the 3rd officer ended up sleeping at John Allen Midget Jr.'s house. And his youngest daughter, Bethany, gave up her bed to the 3rd officer, Wilde. And Wilde wrote to the Chickamaucomico, to the Midgets of Chickamaucomico. And Bethany, oddly enough, got the letter. And they corresponded for a while, then lost track of each other. So now the great, great granddaughter of John Allen Midget Jr. is going to start writing to the great, great granddaughter of Victor Wilde.
That's just incredible.
It is incredible.
After all these years to make those connections.
Yeah. She Merlot Ghost said she Googled the Merlot Rescue and found that there was a book. And she found that there was a bookstore on Hatteras Island. And it happens that the owner of the bookstore is on the board of Chickamauga. So she wrote the bookstore and said, could I have 5 copies of the book?
Oh.
And because she wanted to give, the book is, what is the name of the book? Into the Burning Sea, the story of the dauntless devotion to duty.
Hmm. They'll love reading that. So with the property, it's not just a tour of the life-saving station, but you actually do other events there now.
Yeah, we have, we do a variety of events. We do bus tours The bus tour business was severely affected by COVID, but it's just starting to come back now. We do bus tours. We do weddings. The first wedding, we used to do weddings informally. People used to just say, can I get married at the station? And then we said, wait, we could make money doing weddings. we could side a building with the money we could get from weddings. So we did weddings. Weddings disappeared again during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
We've done Coast Guard retirements. A couple of Coast Guard officers wanted to have their retirement party at Chickamauga. We do a lot of team building with the Coast Guard. So that we have people like November 5th, we have people coming down from Elizabeth City and a group coming down from Chesapeake, Virginia. And they'll do some team building stuff at Chickamauga. And we have various groups come in.
Now, I know you said you close for the season in early November and reopen when?
Around April? Easter time.
It, okay.
Usually and, before Easter or the week after, depending on how early Easter is.
And you're staffed by volunteers, mostly, or completely? Mostly.
Right now we have one paid staff who's the manages the site. I'm the executive director and my salary, I'm a volunteer. All of the board are volunteers. All of the people that do the drill every Thursday are volunteers.
So for anyone that may want to come down, maybe they're staying in the area for an extended period of time and want to volunteer, how would they get in touch with you?
They would just call the station. At 252-987-1552. If we're closed, we monitor the phone every day or so, every couple of days for sure. You can go to our website, chickamauga.org, and that will put you in touch with us. We have a Facebook page. I don't think we have Instagram, but we may have Instagram by the time you think of it. So that's how you get in touch with us. You can donate through it. We are a 501(c). So to the extent that donations are still tax exempt, you can deduct your taxes by giving us a promotion.
And you also have some things they can purchase through the website?
Absolutely. We just have it. We have pictures of stuff, just to give you a tidbit of what we have. If you call us up, we will describe stuff. We will send you pictures of stuff that we have. It's all related to life-saving and rescue. We were at a seafood festival yesterday, Saturday, and two Coast Guard aviators, a husband and wife team, came by and were looking at the helicopter toys and saying, "I fly those."
So for those coming out to visit, what's the easiest way to drive to your area?
We are right on Route 12.
So it's basically...
Everything on Hatteras Island is right on Route 12. We only have one road.
But to get to Route 12...
to get to Route 12, you cross what is currently the Mark Basnight Bridge, which is an engineering marvel. It replaced the Bonner Bridge, which was also an engineering marvel. Mm-hmm. And you'll go across a smaller bridge called the Richard Etheridge Bridge. Richard Etheridge was a keeper at Pea Island Station, which was two stations to our north. And there's nothing left of Pea Island Station, unfortunately.
It's a beautiful drive down there. You're only, I'm going to round this off, what, about 25 miles or so south of Nag's Head? Maybe 35, closer to that. Yeah, somewhere around there. And it's a beautiful drive, especially crossing the bridge. The new bridge over Oregon Inlet is just a beautiful view. And
then you drive through the wildlife refuge, and we're probably, just as you come into the village of Rodanti, you've probably driven 14 miles through a wildlife refuge, and you can pull over and look at birds and all kinds of things. Or you could go to their visitor center, which is about halfway. So after you do that 14 miles, we're probably another mile down the road.
So for those driving in from the mainland, basically, if you're coming down I-95, you're going to find around Rocky Mount, North Carolina, US 64. Take that east. That'll take you all the way through Manio and on over to Nag's Head. And then it's NC 12 south from there. So it's a really easy drive to get out there.
Or you come down I-95 from the north, or if you want to drive along the coast, old Route 13. Which now has all kinds of bypasses. It's pretty much a high-speed road now.
It's just a beautiful area out there. So I hope our listeners take advantage of that. John, thank you so much for spending some time with us today and telling us the stories and everything that the Life Saving Station has to offer. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.